supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Additional accusers took the witness stand today at Bill Cosby's sexual assault retrial at the Montgomery County Courthouse in Norristown. I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Joining me live on the line with the latest from Norristown is WHYY's Bobby Allen. Bobby, review what took place today.
So we heard from, so far, three of five accusers who, for the first time, are confronting Bill Cosby in court. Now remember, these five women claim that they were sexually molested or assaulted by Cosby in the 80s. Their cases are too old to prosecute, but they are taking the stand now and recalling their stories, and prosecutors are hoping it shows the jury that Cosby had an alleged pattern of behavior in which he would seduce women, drug them, and then sexually assault them. And the prosecution is hoping that will help show that Andrea Constant, who's at the heart of the criminal trial, was not an isolated person, that she was part of this larger pattern. Now, there were some fireworks. And in fact, Heidi Thomas, one of the witnesses, when she was asked, "Do you want to, you know, why are you here? Why are you taking the stand?" And she said, quote, "I want to see a serial rapist convicted." And people audibly gasped in the courtroom. The judge had to rebuke her because, of course, Cosby's not on trial for rape. He's on trial for aggravated indecent assault. And she said that while speaking over the judge. The other really dramatic moment is when an accuser, Shailon Lasha, took the stand. And she was just inconsolable. I mean, she was weeping loudly, covering her face with a handkerchief. The prosecutor said, "Is this hard for you?" And haltingly, she said, "Yes, it is." And right before she got off the stand, she looked at Cosby in the eyes and said, "You remember this, don't you, Mr. Cosby?" And he made a little smirk.
To which, apparently, Cosby's lawyers asked for a mistrial.
They did ask for a mistrial, and the judge swiftly said no.
What's the defense's cross-examination strategy?
So the defense is emphasizing that these women didn't come forward until the criminal charges from Andrea Constant's case made national headlines. And they're doing that to try to imply to the jury that these women are just jumping on the bandwagon, right? They're also trying to strongly suggest that, you know, these women were driven by a desire for publicity. The last woman who was just on the stand, her name was Janice Baker Kenny. Her lawyer is you know, well-known lawyer, plaintiff's lawyer, Gloria Allred, and there was a number of questions in which the defense team was basically saying, "Oh, did Gloria Allred put you up to this? Are you overly scripted by Gloria Allred? How much coaching did you receive by her?" As a way of sort of saying, "Oh, you're not really telling the truth, but you only came out to get publicity, and you're only here because Gloria Allred put you up to it."
WHYY's Bobby Allen reporting from the courthouse in Norristown. In other news today, Philadelphia City Council President Daryl Clark announced a package of affordable housing bills. The initiatives include a 1% tax on all new construction. There will also be a series of measures allowing developers to construct taller buildings with more units if they provide more affordable housing. Clark says the money from the construction tax will go to build new affordable housing for both moderate and low-income residents. It's also expected to be earmarked for a down payment assistance program to boost home ownership.
Well, we want to make sure that everybody has an opportunity to live in a nice neighborhood like Point Breeze, right? To live in a nice neighborhood like Society Hill, to live in a nice neighborhood like Francisville and Brewerytown. That's what we're seeking.
The bills will be introduced tomorrow morning in City Council. Hand in hand with the lack of affordable housing, Philadelphia is also facing an eviction crisis, with thousands of city residents being forced out of their homes every year. A new database launched this week called the Eviction Lab shows that this epidemic is not unique to Philadelphia. Created by Princeton University's Matthew Desmond, the new tool also shows that Philadelphia suffers far more from evictions than most major cities. The news comes on this, the 50th anniversary of the Fair Housing Act, signed into law by then-President Lyndon B. Johnson. Joining me now to discuss evictions and the state of fair housing today is Ariella Cohen from WHYY's Plan Philly Project. Ariella, let's start with Matthew Desmond's findings. What does the research show that we didn't know already?
Well, Philadelphia has known for a while that has a problem with people losing the roof over their heads, you know, due to eviction. But Desmond's data shows that we really stand out. In raw numbers, Philly has the fourth highest number of evictions among large cities. So that means that we have more than two times the evictions that LA experiences, even though we have less than half the population. And we're only outstripped by New York and Houston, which also have significantly larger populations than us. And then there's Indianapolis up there that is also beating us for some reason. And then in terms of our eviction rate, that's the rate of renters who leave court with a judgment saying that they have to get out. We're 81st out of the top 100 list, and no other big cities out of the other five big cities in the country crack that top 100 list.
What toll does high eviction rates take on communities?
Well, Desmond's research has shown us that it really affects kids a lot. People have to transfer out of their schools. They're getting moved around unexpectedly. Their parents might lose their jobs because they don't have a home. They don't have a stable roof over their head. And then we find that it can contribute to neighborhood decline. There's more vacancy. It just keeps that churn and instability in a neighborhood.
Tie this problem back to the fair housing issue that Johnson was trying to solve 50 years ago.
Yeah, I mean, evictions are a symptom of a housing system that still today isn't serving everyone equally well. In Philadelphia, you see that a lot of low-income or majority black areas have the highest rates of eviction. That's indicating that people are having a hard time securing safe, decent, affordable, and stable housing. That's something that the Fair Housing Act was trying to solve. And it also shows that people tend to still live in areas that are segregated by class and race, another issue the Fair Housing Act was trying to solve.
How's the city responding to the problem?
Councilwoman Helen Gim got $500,000, I think, last year for fighting evictions over the next few years. It's not a ton of money, but it's helping to support tenants in rent court. In the past, most tenants don't have lawyers. They can't afford them. So they're up against landlords who can certainly afford these lawyers. So that way, it's a more equal playing field for tenants.
Put that $500,000 in context with what other cities are devoting to the issue.
Yeah, well, it's not much compared to what New York City has put into the issue. They've put hundreds of millions into it. But it's something. And we're doing better than many of the smaller cities that have higher rates of eviction than Philadelphia at this point. So, you know, we're not quite where the larger cities are in fighting the problem, but we're hopefully making some progress in the right direction.
Thanks, Ariella.
Thanks, Dave.
Ariella Cohen from WHYY's Plan Philly Project. April is Autism Awareness Month, and new research is shedding light on possible risk factors for the disorder. A team at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia recently discovered that mitochondria, which in part tell the story of where your ancestors are from, could play a role, and certain lineages may be more predisposed than others. Joining me is Dr. Douglas Wallace, director of the Center for Mitochondrial and Epigenomic Medicine at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. Doug, first off, what exactly are mitochondria?
Mitochondria are actually bacteria that live inside our cells. These bacteria generate 90% of all the energy that we use in our lives. So the mitochondria have been called in introductory biology the powerhouse of the cell, or the power plants. But that's actually a very great simplification because the mitochondria have many, many functions, including making energy.
So is it the mitochondria energy run awry that causes this predisposition?
Yes, that's our paper showed that DNA, which located inside these bacteria, because they are separate life forms, this DNA can be mutated or altered, and that alteration can be a factor in predisposition to autism.
And in turn, how is that traced back to one's ancestral lineage based on geography?
So it turns out that these mitochondrial DNAs, as people migrated to different environments, allowed their energy metabolism to change subtly to be optimal for different environments. For example, If you live in Africa and you want to survive and you're a woman, you need to run away from lions. Running away from lions requires a lot of ATP. That's what mitochondria make to have us do work. And so you would want to be maximally efficient at making ATP so you could run most rapidly. However, the mitochondria also generate heat because every calorie that you eat is a unit of heat. So the more calories you burn, the more heat you generate. So when people moved to the Arctic, the lions froze to death, so that wasn't a problem. But the problem was that the people were freezing to death. So how did that get solved? The mitochondria became less efficient at making ATP. So then they had to eat more calories for the same amount of work and generate more heat, and that allowed them to survive in the cold. So these kinds of adjustments of energy metabolism by the mitochondrial DNA, which, by the way, is the wiring diagram of your power plants, allowed our ancestors to live in different parts of the world. But what's interesting about that is what was good in one environment, let's say living in the Arctic, might not be the optimal kind of energy to live in New York City or Philadelphia. And so now we're getting a mismatch between the environment and the our ancient genetic history, and those mismatches are affecting our predilection to a number of diseases, one of which is autism.
So to amplify that point, it is that mismatch which creates the tension and the potential for heightened predisposition to autism.
Well, let's just say that some mitochondrial DNA genotypes, types of mitochondrial DNA, are better at making energy and some are a little less good at making energy. And the brain, which is only 2% of your body, uses 20% of all your mitochondrial energy. So people that happen to have slightly less efficient mitochondria, which normally wouldn't be a big problem, it is enough of a problem that if there is an environmental challenge or some other challenge, can tip their brain over the minimum energy it needs for proper development, and then that creates a wiring problem in the brain, and that then predisposes, we believe, to autism.
Is the state of genetic and more specifically mitochondrial testing advanced to the extent that one could determine if one has a predisposition to autism?
Well, that's a really good question, but we have to be a bit careful here because a predisposition or a risk factor, as we call it, is not the same as getting the problem. None of the mitochondrial DNAs that we studied are in and of themselves the cause of autism. Rather, they change a person's metabolism in such a way that with other factors, say changes in the nuclear DNA or an environmental challenge, those together might cause the person to have some problems with the development of their brain and the potential of getting autism.
How might this correlation advance efforts to, if not cure, treat autism?
We're very active here at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia of trying to develop new kinds of therapies to increase energy metabolism. And by doing that, then, we would envision having drugs or gene therapy that could, in fact, slightly increase the energy metabolism of people at risk and thus ameliorate the symptoms. And that's actively what we're working on now.
Dr. Wallace, thanks so much for joining us to shed light on this study and its implications.
Well, thank you, Dave, and it's been great talking to you. I hope you have a great day.
I'm speaking with Dr. Douglas Wallace, director of the Center for Mitochondrial and Epigenomic Medicine at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. The NBA playoffs get underway this weekend, and for the first time in a long while, Sixers fans will not be on the sidelines. Following a string of losing seasons, the team is finally competing. What changed? WHYY's Aaron Mozell explains the process.
The Sixers have stunned a lot of basketball fans this year. Just two seasons ago, the team flirted with the worst record in the NBA. Now, they're not just limping into the playoffs, they're galloping.
Here's Simmons, McConnell, Holmes slamming for two.
To understand how the Sixers reached the postseason, we have to rewind to 2013. That year, the franchise hired a new general manager, Sam Hinkie. Right away, it was clear he wanted to do things differently. Here he is during an early press conference discussing his approach to rebuilding the team.
We should try to keep our end goal in mind, which is to build a championship-caliber team in Philly. That won't come overnight.
Hinkie said winning games in the short term was less important. In fact, the Sixers intentionally signed bad players so the teams would lose a lot. If you're not a basketball fan, you're probably scratching your head right now. But in the NBA, the worst teams get to pick first in the draft. And so by tanking season after season, the franchise got a crack at signing superstars season after season. The kind of players a team needs to win a title. Guys like point guard Ben Simmons and center Joel Embiid. The strategy became known as the process. And at first, it was a tough sell for a lot of people. Spike Eskin co-hosts a popular podcast about the Sixers. He says some people could never get behind the process. They thought it was wrong, even immoral, for a pro basketball team to not even try to win. And Eskin says fans didn't want to watch a terrible team.
Sports are there for us to be happy. You know, they are a leisure activity that is supposed to be exciting. And when the team loses, there's very little exciting about that. And I understand the frustration.
It also wasn't the best time to be one of the team's broadcasters. Mark Zumoff is the play-by-play announcer for NBC Sports Philadelphia. He says he often had to dig deep into his notes to keep things entertaining.
You might be down 25 points and it's the fourth quarter, and you're literally at that point not describing the action. Instead, you might have several possessions, three, four, or five at a time, where you're telling a story or you're into a discussion with your partner. Because as a broadcaster, you're trying to salvage the situation and you hope that you can keep the audience interested because the game is no longer a game, it's a blowout.
Things started getting better in 2016. The Sixers still lost a lot, but it seemed for the first time that the process might actually be heading in the right direction. Around that time, even casual fans started embracing the rebuilding plan. The phrase, trust the process, first uttered in an ESPN interview, became the team's motto and a viral hashtag on social media. And yet, few could have predicted what's happened this season. The Sixers have one of the top playoff seeds in the Eastern Conference after winning more than 50 games, something they haven't done since Allen Iverson was on the team.
Last call for season ticket members. Running out of time. Black hole entrance is where you want to get in.
Before a recent game against the Cleveland Cavaliers, lines snaked outside the Wells Fargo Center before tip-off. Alney resident Cynthia Griffin says she supported the Sixers even when they were awful, but she couldn't be happier the team has turned things around.
Every season was kind of like a nail biter. You was on the edge of your seat. You was tense. Now you just be relaxed, watching the game, enjoying the game. It's like a party.
And she's got high hopes for the Sixers.
Right now, the city is a winning city. You know, we had the Eagles, then Villanova. So now it's our turn to bring the parade to Center City.
A few years ago, that would have sounded delusional. These days, not so much. Fans have trusted the process, and it paid off. Now, they're putting their trust in the team it made. Aaron Mozell, WHYY News.
The 76ers finish up the regular season tonight at home against the Milwaukee Bucks. And tomorrow evening, Philadelphia Daily News sports writer Marcus Hayes will join us to look ahead at the playoffs and how the Sixers might fare. A man known in Philadelphia for owning a string of Center City parking lots has a second life as a Bart breeder of koi. Joe Zaritsky, CEO of the Parkway Corporation, has been passionate about the Japanese decorative fish for a half century. WHYY's Peter Crimmins reports he's now donating most of his fish to the Japanese house in Fairmount Park.
The Shofuso House and Garden in Fairmount Park is one of the finest recreations in America of 17th century Japanese architecture and craftsmanship. For 60 years, it has overlooked a placid pond filled with koi.
They were, let's say, lower quality fish, and the setting here is so absolutely perfect. Even in Japan, this would be considered an absolutely beautiful samurai home and garden. It really deserved higher quality fish.
That is Joe Zaritsky, the CEO of the Parkway Corporation, and he knows his fish. He has bred koi for almost two decades and has been a judge of koi competitions in Japan, which he calls beauty pageants.
It's the coloring and where it falls on the body. So these fish, the patterns are falling well. That could have a little more white on it, but it is an absolutely beautiful young female. One day we're going to reproduce her.
Zaritsky has introduced 32 fish into the pond with a promise to regularly add more koi from his breeding operation in New Jersey, where he used to sell to discerning koi hobbyists as a side business. That was separate from his real estate and parking lot empire. But it was a business that didn't really make any money. Now 78, he says his children don't have any interest in raising fish, so he donated the farm at Carneys Point in New Jersey to Rowan University. Zaritsky says he will still be able to use the farm to raise koi in order to keep the Shofuso house stocked.
Simplicity, beauty from simplicity is really what the Japanese are, their art is all about. And this is one of the art forms in Japan.
Zaritsky's donation was announced during the Cherry Blossom Festival, an annual Japanese culture celebration now underway at the Shofuso House. Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
South Jersey's Cowtown and Rodeo might bring images of tumbleweeds to mind, but a new effort to preserve hundreds of acres of grassland means the farm's heritage and ecology stays put. For WHYY News, Kyrie Greenberg reports.
Steve Eisenhower directs the preservation group Natural Lands. He began working with Cowtown owners, the Harris family, several years ago to monitor a species of small falcon called a kestrel.
There was only one active kestrel nest around this area at that time, and now we have seven just on this farm.
Now, partners with the New Jersey Conservation Foundation and the U.S. Department of Agriculture have preserved more than 350 acres of the Cowtown spread. It's the first effort to preserve grassland in New Jersey. Grant Harris says his family will continue to own and operate Cowtown, rodeos, roping, bull riding, and all, but the new restrictions will keep housing developers off his lawn.
It is farming, ranching, whatever you want to call it, but keeping that grass healthy and productive is key to our operation. And to do anything but take good care of it would be very short-sighted.
The Cowtown Ranch has been in the Harris family for five generations. For WHYY News, Kyrie Greenberg.
That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Benyakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. Find us on your favorite podcast app or listen back at whyy.org/news. Thanks for listening. I'm Dave Heller. NewsWorks Tonight.